whatever the elite rules, it will be called centrist. The transgender project, for example, is a project of the so-called centrists, but most people would not consider it a centrist understanding of the world, right? There is no real sense that you have the forces of capital on the right and the forces of labor on the left and reasonable people in the middle trying to mediate between the two. That sort of center doesn't exist anymore.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Christopher Caldwell. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brendan. Good to be here.
It's great to have you back on. There is a lot of stuff I want to ask you about public life, political life, America, Europe. In your capacity as a writer for the Claremont Review of Books, First Things, The Wall Street Journal, The Spectator, too many other publications to mention, you've always got interesting things to say on all those questions. But I really want to kick off, I guess, with a pretty basic question, which I'm always keen to ask American folk, which is what the hell is going on in American politics right now? To us outsiders, it looks like it's a bit of a mess. It looks like the next presidential election will be a rerun of the last one, two old duffers battling out for the White House. And it seems that one of them is so unstable, he's not even fit to stand trial for secreting away top secret documents. And the other one is still a bit of a loudmouth and has got loads of trials and accusations stacking up against him. So it looks a bit crazy, I think, to the average outside observer. What's your take on where American politics is at right now and what might happen with a presidential election?
Oh, boy. Well, it is a bit crazy in its outward appearance, but there's a logic to it. It's a basic, basic populist elite problem. So a lot of people, you know, they look at, I think the basic error that most people look at when they look at American politics is they say, Americans are so stupid, they don't understand what a lunatic Donald Trump is. And that's the first thing, that is the basic thing that you have to get out of your mind. Whoever you are, wherever you are on the political spectrum, the American voter sees the same Donald Trump that you do. He knows that, you know, Donald Trump runs a kind of a sleazy business that had, you know, that basically puts up these, you know, cheap casinos and things like that, that he's often, let's say, economical with the truth, that he, you know, they know all these things about Donald Trump. So the question is not, you know, don't you know that Donald Trump said these things about women on this or that tape? The question is, how bad does the situation in the United States have to be that Americans would choose to vote for Donald Trump? From that lens, I'd say that we have a basic populist elitist problem of the kind that will be familiar, you know, from the Brexit argument, from Italian politics in the times of the Five Star Movement, from the farmers movement and on the streets of Europe today. It's that same kind of thing. The United States is, the United States, possibly with the exception of Britain, was the first country to go down this route of deindustrialization, financialization, sort of the shift of the focus of politics into cultural issues, and so we have a rather advanced discussion of that. Okay, and we can just start from there.
That's a very good starting point. And what you said really echoed what I've heard when I speak to, you know, well-meaning liberals here in the UK or people on the left. They will often say about Americans and Trump what you've just summarized there. They will say, you know, how stupid can the average American be to go for someone like Trump? Don't they know what an awful person he is? Don't they know that he used the P word and he's very abrasive and he eats cheeseburgers and he has lots of dodgy business deals? That's what they will say. And I always want to shake them by the scruff of the neck and say, listen, That's the point. The fact that they are still willing to plumb for someone like that tells us a bigger story about America. But I wonder, do you think it's possible that the crusade against Trump by some sections of the elite, which has now taken the form of numerous legal trials and accusations. Now, some of them, I'm sure, have good grounding, but it does seem to the average observer that they're stacking up in a fairly vindictive way, and that there might be a bit of a political crusade behind some of this lawfare against Donald Trump. Do you think it's possible that that crusade against him might actually backfire on the elites? And the more they go after him, the more it's possible that some voters will align with him and recognize that just as they are treated with contempt by sections of the elite, so Trump is too, and feel that kind of bond with him as someone who's being bullied, if you like.
Yes, I think it's possible. I'm not sure it's happening, but it's quite possible. And how this will all shake out is going to depend a lot on, you know, what issues come up in the course of the campaign. It's kind of unpredictable. But I think that in terms of presenting these prosecutions as a simple exercise in ensuring good government, Trump's opponents are not doing very well right now. I mean, there are basically four different tracks that they're following. You know, as your listeners will know, there's the accusation that he tried to, let's say, subvert the Georgia election by calling election officials. There's the accusation that he stole or he took possession of top secret papers at his house. There's the accusation that he fomented a riot or an insurrection, as it's sometimes called, on January 6th, as the votes were being counted for president. And that goes in several directions, from, you know, trying to prosecute him to keeping him off the ballot. And finally, there's this case which seemed to come to a head a couple of weeks ago with a verdict about whether he misvalued his properties in New York for the sake of getting a loan. Now, I don't want to go into all of these, although I'll go into any of them you like. But I would just, you know, I'd say just, I think that one of the weakest ones is the one that was just decided in New York. And that's very symptomatic of the problem that you describe. Because Trump, having already been fined $83 million for having disparaged a woman who brought a rape accusation against him that has never been proved in court. The woman is 80, by the way, the woman who brought this accusation against him. Having already been fined $83 million, he was now fined close to $500 million for a financial violation. Now, the particular violation on which he was fined was misvaluing his real estate holdings, and particularly his apartment, for the sake of getting a loan from Deutsche Bank at a better rate, which he later paid back. The loan is all paid off. So Deutsche Bank did not suffer. So there are a lot of problems with this case. One is that there's no damaged person. There's no person bringing the case against him. It's just the state of New York bringing the case against him. The other is the nature of the accusation, because this happened about 20 years ago. Any American who was alive 20 years ago can remember the climate of, let's say, of money lending and borrowing just on the eve of the 2008 crash, when banks would come to you and say, "We'd like to give you a credit card. Tell us how much you earn, and we promise you we won't check it." You know, that was the climate then. What Trump did was he apparently doubled, I believe, the square footage of one of his apartments. That's what he's being accused of. He has been fined close to $500 million. And that's the third thing. To put this in perspective, okay, this week, it might be coming down today, but the European Commission is fining Apple for keeping Spotify out of the European music market. This is over the course of several years. So this is we're talking about 500 million people. We're talking about the richest trading block in the world. And the fine for that is about $500 million. That is, it's the same fine that Donald Trump is being assessed for misrepresenting the number of square feet in his apartment. So there's something a little bit, I think that people feel there's something a little bit off about it.
Absolutely. And the way you've described it there is very well put. And no wonder people feel there's something off about this. You said I could ask you about any of the cases that I wanted to. So I do want to ask you about one of them, in addition to the one you've just talked about, which is the removal or the attempted removals of Trump from certain primary ballot papers. There have been efforts to have him struck off under the 14th Amendment because of his alleged incitement of an insurrection in the Capitol. To me, that looks like a particularly egregious act against Trump by an elite that might actually now be overplaying its hand, because my view is that if you are, you know, physically trying to prevent people from voting for a representative that they want to vote for, then that is a direct interference in the democratic process. So what have Americans made, and what have you made of those attempts to actually remove him from the ballot paper on the basis of the 6th of January events?
Yeah, well, I think that Trump's supporters take it the same way you do, as a trespass against democracy. But it's worth noting that Trump's opponents, while I'm sure some of them are cynical, many of them are really sincere in considering Trump a criminal. And in an interesting thing about the, for instance, about the January 6th case, which is the one of these cases that was most misplayed, I think, because the Justice Department sort of like devoted a ton of resources to prosecuting these small fry, you know? I mean, the idea was that there was going to be a big conspiracy trial about January 6th. It was going to culminate in Donald Trump. But bizarrely, they've prosecuted like, 1,000 people, holding them in solitary confinement. Some of them were just people who were out, marching for the day. None of them were armed. And some of them are doing serious jail time. The theory of that, the important thing to remember, kind of in defense of the Democrats or kind of in defense of the Justice Department, is they seem to sincerely believe that at the end of this, they were going to find some masterminded plot. So in a certain sense, yes, they are playing fast and loose with the word insurrection, which is in the 14th Amendment and does permit people to be kept off the ballot. But it had a very specific meaning when it was written, like other things in the 14th Amendment. That was in there to keep Confederates from intentionally mucking up the political process right after the Civil War. And in the same way, there was a bit about respecting the national debt, and that was in there just to keep Confederate states from claiming that they were not responsible for paying the national debt because they hadn't been in the Union during the Civil War. But these are all, this part of the Constitution is all explicitly and exclusively directed towards things that happened between 1861 and 1865. That's a roundabout way of saying that it looks very cynical, this use of it. But they actually, I do think that there is a sincere belief that Trump was managing an insurrection, and it has survived the lack of proof of that in the same way that certain claims about Trump's involvement with Russia have survived the lack of truth about that.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I want to invite you to my next very special live recording of this podcast. On Thursday, 21st of March at 7 p.m, I will be joined by the brilliant Matt Ridley, a science writer and the co-author of Viral, The Search for the Origin of COVID-19. Matt and I will be live and in conversation via Zoom, talking about the cover-up of the lab leak theory, the dire consequences of lockdown, the perils of net zero, and other things too. We'll also be taking questions from you, the audience, so if you have something you want to ask Matt, now is your chance. This is a free event exclusive to Spiked supporters, our online donor community. If you're already a Spiked supporter, you can sign up for your ticket now on our online donor hub. If you're not already a Spiked supporter, now is the perfect time to become one. For as little as £5 a month, you can get your ticket to this event, plus you'll enjoy loads of other exclusive perks like ad-free reading, access to our comments section, and to other free events like this one. To become a Spiked supporter, go to www.spiked-online.com/supporters. That's www.spiked-online.com/supporters. I'll see you there on Thursday, the 21st of March at 7 p.m. with Matt Ridley. Yeah, I've been reading about some of the 6th of January participants or rioters and the sentences that have been handed down to them. I've seen some people use the term redneck Guantanamo to refer to some of the conditions that I wouldn't necessarily call them rednecks, but that's the phrase that some people are using. And it is pretty scary what's being done to some of them. And I guess that speaks to partly to the climate that emerged straight after the 6th of January events, which was this idea that there is this huge problem of domestic terrorism. That's how it was referred to. And this idea, I guess, amongst sections of the elite, that there are significant sections of American society who are semi-fascists, to use one of Biden's phrases, or, you know, the basket of deplorables, of course, to hark back to Hillary Clinton's old phrase. Or if we want to go back even further, Barack Obama's claim that there are sections of American society that cling to their guns and their Bibles and who are untrusting of foreigners or outsiders. That view, is that still there within the Democratic establishment? I hear Biden giving a voice to it every now and then, but do you think that's still a significant problem for the Democrats, that they just feel incredibly alienated from some of the people who would traditionally have been their voters, and particularly working class people, who they now look upon with a very strong sense of moral disdain and moral disapproval? They don't like the way they live, the way they speak, their cultural activities, their community life. Is that still a problem in this year going forward to the next election, where the Democrats just can't connect with those people?
Yes, that is their big problem. I mean, we started off talking about terrorism and how the different parties diagnose terrorism. And yes, Democrats did explicitly have over the last 10 years talked about, you know, sort of rural white nationalist, angry right wing things like this. You know, it's worth remembering a lot of the tools that the government has permitted itself to use against terrorism, to sort of like classify people as terrorists and then say, well, now we don't have to live up to the same sort of like level of government responsibility when we go after these guys. Those come from the era after September 11th, and they come from George Bush. And a lot of people said, you know, hey, you want to be careful. These things that you think are just being targeted at Al-Qaeda are going to come back and be used against American citizens. And they were right. It's really worth remembering that. And it was an opening for the Patriot Act that George W. Bush passed was an opening for people to say, well, all right, we don't like these. Democrats were never great enthusiasts of this sort of like anti-civil liberties view anyway. But they said, if the government's going to have these tools, let's make sure they're used against everybody. Okay. So that's one problem. It's a real problem. The Democrats being in power are the main abusers of this system now, but it's a bad system to start with. Okay. There's the second issue that you raised about the Democrats being alienated from ordinary Americans totally. I mean, look, both the parties presided over this dismantling of the industrial economy, and we're still finding out just how, what a mistake that was in many ways. But funnily, Democrats are getting a lot more blame for this than Republicans are. Why is that? Well, one reason is that the Democrats are the party of the universities, and they've come to represent a cultural elite. And so there's a snobbiness to their electorate that is, does not go unremarked by the working class. But I think that a lot of it is also that the Republicans used to be the party of capitalism. They went out and they stood on the hustings and they said, you know, we want ruthless competition. It was really what you say is what you get. But the Democrats had a different approach. The Bill Clinton approach, like the Tony Blair approach, and like the approach of like countless other sort of like new people of the center of the left throughout the world, was to say, look, we're going to have to close your factory, but we're going to take care of you. It's a promise, you know? And once the economy was reconfigured, it was very hard to keep that promise. And so there's towards the working class, there's kind of an explicit, you know, there's an ideological disagreement with the center right and its capitalists, but there's an explicit betrayal with the center left and its, you know, social Democrats.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. And in fact, I wanted to ask you about, I guess, the future of social democracy more broadly. I wanted to get your thoughts on this, because it seems to me, not only in the American context, but in the European context as well, and I want to ask you a few questions about Europe, social democracy has shifted from being something that at least aspired to represent working class people and working class interests and questions of class and economic clout, or at least economic comfort, you know, the questions that used to drive the left for a very long time, to being, you know, some of these social democratic parties have very much become the property of the graduate elites across Europe. If you look at who staffs these parties, who runs them, and who is more likely to vote for them, it is increasingly people higher up the social ladder, whereas people lower down the social ladder are plumbing for right-wing parties or populist parties or whatever else it might be. And I wanted to get your thoughts on what you think that means for the realignment of politics more broadly. I mean, are we witnessing the end of the left as we used to know it? I mean, people have been talking about the end of the left for almost as long as the left has existed. But I guess when you have such a strong realignment of social democracy away from working people and towards the upper middle classes and their rather eccentric views and values and woke ideas and so on, it does seem to me that that's a realignment that's not going to be easily reversed. And do you think there's something about this now that really speaks to the future of politics and the changing nature of politics?
Absolutely. The only reason the left is still called the left is because it is the party in power, and it believes that left is the coolest description. And so they've claimed it for themselves. But actually, if you ask what a left and what a right actually are, you know, I would say that the right is the party of ownership of capital and property. It's the party of order. It's the party that says what's legal and what's not. It is the party of dogma. It's the party that sort of like of it's the it used to be the party of the church, but at any rate, it's the party that sets out like ideas of this is the moral way to behave. And in all of those things, the people who call themselves the left are really a party of the right. It's what they structurally, that's what they are. So I tend not to want to use those words very much. I mean, and so if you can say these old parties, these old working men's parties, how did they come to be sort of like parties of the universities and, you know, sort of like against the interests of people of the actual working class. And, you know, there was always a kind of funny thing. These working class movements, particularly after the Russian Revolution, got a lot of sympathy from intellectuals. I mean, from people whose class interests were not necessarily with the working class, but who nonetheless thought this was a better a better way to organize society. It would be more stable. It would be more moral. And so they hitched their wagon to these things. But as the industrialization happened, it's not just that the factories closed. It's just that it's also that the new center of economic activity and productivity moved to ideas, that is, moved to the universities. So suddenly this part of the left-wing party, the intellectuals in the left-wing parties, even if they weren't personally rolling in dough, okay, they were either the people who were like working in the new startups, or they were beneficiaries of the philanthropy of the foundations that came out of these startups. That is, they were tenured professors and things like that. So they were really the haves of this new university-centered economy. And so that's, I think, a big part of what's happening.
I wonder what you think might be the driving force behind those sections of American society who still vote for Trump, regardless of all his problems, which they are very well aware of. Do you think it's their sense of economic insecurity or their sense of cultural insecurity? Or maybe it's a combination of the two, but it's always interesting to me which one takes precedence at any particular time. So a friend of mine here in Britain tells me a funny story about the time he was campaigning for a political party in Leeds in the north of England, large working class, predominantly working class city. And they were set up their stall on the local high street, and they were saying, you know, we'll build more houses. We will make sure that you get your unemployment benefit on time. We will agitate for a higher minimum wage, all those kind of very traditional ideas economically. And people were just walking past. And then my friend decided to start saying, we're the only party who thinks that women don't have penises. And suddenly people were stopping. They were obviously very curious by this man saying a rather strange thing in a public place. But they stopped and they talked and they engaged. So there is obviously working class communities across the Western world right now are very concerned about economic insecurity, but also equally and sometimes even more so about cultural insecurity, the sense that their nations no longer really belong to them, that even the borders of their nations have become very fluid and porous, and that the establishments of their nations are like an alien race in some ways, who live on a completely different planet and have completely different values. Is it a combination of those two things that drives the support for Trump, or do you think one takes precedence over the other?
No, I think you've got it. I think they're very hard to disentangle. I mean, Trump has his strengths and weaknesses in both economic and cultural areas. The border is the key issue going on right now. It's really vivid. You see these people who they look foreign. They're at the barbed wire gates of the country in enormous numbers, in thousands, in tens of thousands, or they're streaming into the country. And you see them on television. If you watch Fox News, you'll see pictures of this every night. It's just like a flowing mass of people. It seems like, and probably when you're in bed, you think, you know, like they're still flowing across the border. It's a constant flow. And everyone in Washington has pretended not to do anything about that. Now, Trump was a very ineffective president in a lot of ways. His learning curve was absolutely flat. He didn't know any more about the office of the presidency on the day he left it than on the day he arrived. But he did have certain intuitions, and he did shut down the border bureaucratically with all the tools he had at his disposal. And he was thwarted in some of them. I mean, he used serious tools. He tried to ban migrants from a handful of Muslim countries that he considered, you know, liable to produce terrorists. So he was really working on this issue of people pouring across the border. And so he gets a lot of credit for that. I mean, I think that there were 500,000 people a year coming to the United States under Trump, and there are 2 or 3 million a year coming under Biden. And that's a matter of policy. That's the result of executive orders issued by Biden on his first day in office to great fanfare. Okay, so Trump benefits from that. On the economy, this is an economic issue. I think that the intuition of people, the intuition of a roofer or of a landscape gardener is, if I'm in a town that has 2,000 people in it, and suddenly there are 100 young men arrive in town from a country, you know, where the average laborer makes, you know, $5 a day, then there's going to be downward pressure in my on my wages. And you don't have to be a bigot or full of hatred to have that worry. In fact, the low immigration, if you look at the Trump economy, if you measure it by per capita income, if you measure it by mean income, you take all the income in the country and you split it, it did worse than it did under Obama. It was, you know, there was growth, but it was more modest. If you look at median income, that is, you look at how the average person did, he did better. Under Trump, and by the way, these statistics are clouded a little bit by COVID in the final year. But so we're talking about the first 3 years of the Trump administration. Under Trump, you had lower economic growth, but you had a more even distribution. So there is a of the gains from the economy. And in fact, I've heard some people say it's the first, and this is what the Fed numbers that came out at the time showed, it's the first kind of egalitarian period of economic growth since the 20th century. I'm not saying working men became millionaires, but it felt better. There's something that felt better that's not purely sentiment. There's a measurability to this. And that's why, if I just may conclude, it's why I tend to be, I have an open ear to those people who say that they actually are not feeling this so-called Biden economy as a good economy, even though all the experts are telling us that we're fools for not appreciating what a wonderful economy we're living in. I think we probably have an increased per capita income, but that it's disproportionately skewed towards the rich in the country, as one might expect.
I think what you said there about immigration and the American border really rang true with me, because it seems, from the European context, it seems pretty clear to me that immigration is increasingly the issue through which ordinary people most keenly feel their disenfranchisement and most keenly feel their sense of being out of control of the country in which they live. So in Europe, for example, people are often told, well, there's nothing we can do about the movement of all these people because we're in the European Union, we're in the single market, we have to have freedom of movement. Or they're told this is just a natural phenomenon in the modern post-borders global world, so get used to it. And if they raise complaints about it or raise criticisms of it, they're called xenophobic, they're called racist. So we've seen protests in Ireland recently against some of the consequences of immigration. The immigration levels in Ireland are extraordinary. Around 20% of the Irish population was born outside of Ireland. And Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times pointed out that that's higher than the proportion of people born outside of America during the great melting pot era of the late 1800s.
I have another one for you that's a favorite of mine. I think that 2 or 3% of the Irish population was born outside of Ireland or arrived from outside of Ireland in the last 12 or 18 months. So, I mean, it's extraordinary.
It really is extraordinary. And I go to Ireland a lot. I go to the west of Ireland in particular, where my parents are from. And there are these small towns and villages which have a few hundred people in them. And overnight, 100 immigrants are brought in and they're moved into a hotel. I mean, some of them are Ukrainians, but a lot of them are from other countries as well. And people are getting ticked off. And these people are not racist. I mean, some of them might be, you know, little islanders or something. They might want to preserve a kind of traditional culture, but they're not racist. They do think there's something slightly destabilizing when central government that would people who would never deign to visit these villages just import loads of people who have a different culture, who come from a different country, and they feel like that's a destabilizing thing. And I don't think it's racist or bigoted for them to raise those questions. And of course, you've written about this. We've seen the success of Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, the Sweden Democrats, the right-wing Sweden Democrats in Sweden, of course, Meloni in Italy. There have been these surging populist votes recently, a lot of them are tied to the question of immigration, the impact from the migration crisis of 2015. All of those questions are still very, very pertinent in Europe. Do you think immigration, both in America and Europe, will continue to be a kind of significant moment in the culture war for the coming period?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, you mentioned Ireland. There was there's a guy at the Telegraph in London named Michael Murphy, who just made a video about migration in Ireland. And there's a great scene about Ross Cree. I don't know if you've been reading about that. It's this town in tiny town in County Tipperary where they, where overnight, and this is the migrants tend to be moved in the middle of the night. Usually the migrants moved in and filled the only hotel in town. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's the west of Ireland, it's tourism. And so suddenly you have a town that's sort of like, it's dependent on its tourist trade, but the hotel is full. By the way, it's a great deal for the guy who runs the hotel. He gets a bumped up price for like, and his hotel is full all the time. And it's full of asylum seekers. But the business for everyone else in town is shut down. Anyway, I thought this was a wonderful video, that one in the Telegraph.
Yeah, and there are so many knock-on consequences when the hotels in Ireland get filled up with new arrivals or Ukrainians or whoever it might be. There are knock-on consequences for the restaurants in that town, the shops in that town, lots of which are closing down. I mean, it has severe economic impacts on ordinary Irish people. Further on from that issue, I wanted to ask you about something you wrote about recently in The Spectator, about the longing for a centrist restoration. So listeners will probably know what we're talking about already. There is this desire in Europe, there has been for some time, that some centrist savior will come along and rescue the continent from the evils of populism. I mean, when Macron was first elected, there was a front cover of The Economist showing him walking on water, literally walking on water. And there was all this talk about Macron being the liberal savior of post-Brexit Europe, of populist Europe. Donald Tusk has been returned to power in Poland, and that excited people again. There is this desire that centrism and normality, or what they see as normal political life, what the elite see as normal political life, there is this desire that it will be restored at some point. But that's a bit of a fantasy, isn't it? Even if you look at Macron's France, for example, there have been the Gilets Jaunes riots, there's been farmers' protests, there's been all sorts of pushback against Macron's kind of Jupiter-style regime. So what do you think are the prospects of a centrist restoration, or is it just a pipe dream of the new elite?
I think whatever the elite rules, it will be called centrist. So, I mean, the people, to take your friend up in Leeds talking about, you know, anatomy, you know, about gender and anatomy, the transgender project is a project of the so-called centrists, but most people in the wider society would not consider it a centrist understanding of the world, right? But I would say, you know, there is no center. There is no real sense that you have the forces of capital on the right and the forces of labor on the left and reasonable people in the middle trying to mediate between the two. That sort of center doesn't exist anymore. What you have is a very oligarchic economy. You have a very large number of people, maybe 20% of the population, who are connected to it. And you have the rest of the population that is disconnected. And there's no center really there. I mean, the center of the cultural understanding of society is somewhere in that 20% of the elite. The center of the real concerns of the people is somewhere in that 80%, but they're not in the same place. So what you tend to get is representatives of that 20% who can pull together, you know, for various reasons, a minority of that 80% block and call themselves the center. Tusk is a good example of that. But there are a couple of things going on that show that it's not really working like a regular center. And one is, Tusk is really ruling in a self-advertisedly authoritarian way. He is disciplining political dissent. He's put a couple of law and justice, that's the opposition to his government, a couple of dissenters under arrest. And but the key thing is it's tied into the European Union too. And this is it's a complex thing, but you know, the COVID rescue plan that the European Union laid out of about a trillion euros, Poland was on the hook for about 60 billion of that, which was withheld from Poland while law and justice was in power, and did tremendous damage to the Polish economy. It's now being released to Tusk just because he's Tusk. The justice reforms, which law and justice brought in, that were supposedly the reason for this, have not been undone. I mean, Poland's justice system is the same as it was. It's just that Tusk's party runs it. And so now the money is flowing from the European Union. And so yeah, you can call it centrist if you like, but it's not what we used to mean by centrist.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now on with the show. Yeah, I really agree with that. And I should always indicate that I'm kind of doing secret air quotes when I use the term centrist. I mean, you know, the best example for me, and this is something that you've touched on recently as well in a piece you wrote about Keir Starmer, the best example for me about, you know, the myth of centrism or the myth of centrists as these moderate, normal, decent politicians in a sea of populism and insanity is the fact that numerous of these so-called centrists tried to block the largest democratic vote in the history of the United Kingdom, which was the vote for Brexit. In 2016, we voted in our millions to leave the European Union, and these supposed centrists tried to prevent that from happening, literally to prevent it from being enacted, which would have been the most significant attack on democracy in modern European history, I would say. And Keir Starmer was at the forefront of that. And I remember having numerous media debates where I was saying, look, this doesn't look like moderate behavior to me. This looks like extremist behavior that will offend a great number of ordinary people out there, even including people who voted Remain, many of whom will also be offended by this attempt to stop a democratic vote. I wanted to get your views on Starmer, because you have written about him recently. You wrote that he still doesn't understand the Brexit moment or the Brexit period or Brexit Britain. And he's having lots of troubles right now. We in Britain, you guys have got possibly Biden versus Trump to look forward to. We've got Starmer versus Sunak, which I assure you is far worse. It's like one bank manager or another, you know, two shades of technocracy, really. What do you make of what's happening with the Labour Party here and with Keir Starmer? Do you think he could possibly get into power here by accident, pretty much because he's not the Tories and that's about it?
Yes, I think that's the route. That's the route forward. And the only, that's what people have been saying for a while. I've heard all the discussion about, you know, whether it would help Sunak to pull the election forward or push it as far back as possible. It looks like he wants to push it as far back as possible, but that doesn't seem to be shifting anything in the polls. The only sort of dark cloud I can see for Starmer is that his party's getting really angry over the Middle East. And so the part of the party on, you know, that he purged on the purge of which his, you know, his power rests is reviving. And so I think that Starmer has a lot more to fear within his party than he does from the Tories.
Yeah, I think that's a very good observation. Okay, Christopher, I just want to bring it briefly back to the US before we wrap it up. It would be remiss of me not to ask you about the state of questions of civil rights and the race question in America. The last time I had you on the podcast, we were talking about your excellent book, The Age of Entitlement, America Since the 60s, which is a book in which you talk about some of the problems of the Civil Rights Act, not the civil rights movement or the civil rights idea or the idea of equality, but the Civil Rights Act in terms of the legal powers that it brought to bear on American society and how that proved to be quite problematic. So I did want to get your view on some of the developments that have happened in that part of politics. So firstly, there is the affirmative action question. And the Supreme Court last year took the decision that it was not good and not right and not legal and not proper for universities like Harvard and others to judge a candidate's fitness for entering university according to their race, to bring in the questions of race. And so that really called into question affirmative action, the ideals of affirmative action. And there was a huge uproar over this. There was a lot of discussion about how this was the death knell of black kids getting into universities and it was the end of equality in America. What did you make of that decision and the discussion that it gave rise to? Do you think affirmative action is on its way out, or do you think it's still got legs in it?
No, it certainly still has legs. And when the decision was handed down, I was very skeptical about it. If you remember, these were two cases that were brought by a foundation called Students for Fair Admissions. One was against the University of North Carolina, which is a state school. The other was against Harvard, which is a private school. And there's less of a distinction between the two than meets the eye, because actually private schools receive a ton of state funding. And basically, there was no changing of any rules in this. What the justices basically did was they noted certain unfairnesses. For example, that a black applicant to Harvard who was in the 30th percentile of applicants had a better chance of being admitted than an Asian applicant who was in the 90th percentile of applicants. One of the interesting novelties about these cases was that they didn't argue that affirmative action was racist against the white part of the population, which is still the majority in the country. They argued that it was unfair to Asians, who are still a small minority. And so it made a very powerful point that affirmative action does not actually neutrally protect minorities. But having made that point, they basically got lost in a whole bunch of legalistic language about whether the Harvard program was narrowly tailored. Narrowly tailored is a Supreme Court term of art, whether it's narrowly tailored enough to meet, quote, strict scrutiny, unquote. And none of these things have any meaning, and they offer no guidelines on how to go ahead. So it basically amounted to a message to Harvard. North Carolina did change its rules. Harvard has basically said, okay, we're going to find a different way to get the same result. So no, it did not change affirmative action. The big change in civil rights and the way we understand it has been the humiliation of Claudine Gay over the past winter.
That was going to be my next question. I really want to know what you thought of the Claudine Gay scandal. And listeners will know that this is a reference to the congressional hearing on anti-Semitism last year, where Claudine Gay, then president of Harvard and also the president of MIT and Penn University, didn't give a very good account of themselves and demonstrated what some of us believe to be double standards in relation to freedom of speech. These are universities where infamously you can be cancelled for saying a man is not a woman, but apparently you're at liberty to say there should be the killing of Jewish people. Now, I'm a free speech extremist, or rather a free speech absolutist, to put it rather more a bit more nicely. So I'm open to the suggestion that all forms of speech should be free, so long as they do not directly incite violence. But it was that extraordinary hypocrisy and double standard that really, I think, knocked people for six. And then eventually Claudine Gay was taken out from the presidency of Harvard. There was also the plagiarism scandal that was unveiled, where she had been noted as plagiarizing various things in her academic works. What do you think that told us, not only about Harvard, I guess, and the race discussion there, but also about the culture on American campuses more broadly? I sometimes dream that wokeness on campuses is fizzling out and a new generation is coming through that's a bit more sensible. But then things post 7th of October, the Claudine Gay affair, campuses in America go absolutely crazy with people chanting all sorts of things that from the Israelophobic right through to the anti-Semitic. And then you think to yourself, right, these campuses are still in trouble. So where do you think campuses stand right now politically?
Yeah, I think that you have put your finger exactly on it. I think the problem is the hypocrisy. I would even say that in that hearing on Capitol Hill, when Claudine Gay was accused by Elise Stefanik, a Republican congresswoman, of sort of like being lax towards genocide, she said, "Do you believe that people should be able to call for the genocide of the Jews?" is what Stefanik said. It was actually quite unfair to Gay, because what was going on at Harvard was people were chanting, you know, slogans like "From the River to the Sea" and things like that. Now that is really offensive in some people's eyes, but what Claudine Gay should probably have asked is, what particular utterances are you referring to? I don't think that anyone was really sort of explicitly calling for genocide in so many words. And so it was very hard for her to, she was basically defending a hypothetical. And that's a very hard thing to do. But she was put in a position where she had to either oppose free speech or defend genocide. And it was an impossible position. She tried to fudge it. She said, it depends on the context.
I was going to ask you, just following on from that, when I first saw that congressional hearing, I was flitting between sympathy for Claudine Gay and horror at the double standards, at the hypocrisy, at the fact that, you know, it's well known around the world that these campuses do not tolerate the most basic forms of speech. And yet she was saying it's context dependent if it were to come to something as extreme as that.
Right. And that's exactly it. That's exactly the problem. So she was, on this specific count, she was wrongly accused. But what had happened was that Claudine Gay was a pillar of the woke establishment. She had become president of Harvard because she was a pillar of the woke establishment. She had presided over the disciplining of people who said things that were considered insensitive. It was under her watch that Harvard had become the lowest ranked school on FIRE's ranking of campus speech freedom. So what basically happened when you had these protests, when people started saying these things, is that the club that she had been clobbering, you know, others with, suddenly fell at the feet of congressional Republicans, and they decided to use it. And so they did it, and it was a great humiliation for Gay. But it's important to remember that what really got her kicked out is the disquiet of the donors, you know, and that is enough to, I think, dramatically improve the situation at well-endowed universities like Harvard that really need to keep a good relationship with their donors. But most universities are not really like that. They will be slow to see their free speech climate improved in the same way. So I still believe that woke and all of the excesses that go along with it comes from the basically the enforcement powers that are in the Civil Rights Act. And so I think that universities are going to have less to fear from, you know, in lawsuits before they can really permit a more open kind of speech climate.
That's very well put. And brings me on to my final question for you, Christopher, which is about the future of the culture wars and where you think they might go next, which is hard to tell, unpredictable. They're quite volatile. But something you said there I found very interesting, which is that the club that people like Claudine Gay and many others had used to beat their opponents or silence their opponents or expel the unwoke from polite society or from academic society, it fell at the feet of right-leaning Republicans and they picked it up and used it against their enemies. And I think that's a really good way of putting it. And a worrying insight, I think, into the possibility that some people who would consider themselves on the right side of the culture war, the moral side of the culture war, are sometimes just as inclined to use the tactics of the other side of the culture war when it comes to silencing their opponents or pushing them out or demonizing them and so on. So that for me was a worrying sign, and probably more worrying in the long run, even than Claudine Gay's inability to make a good case for herself and for freedom of speech. So given that, and given all the other things going on in the world, and given what we started off talking about, which is that the populist versus the elites conflict continues, what do you think are the prospects for the culture wars, these divides, these battles that are gripping our society in the next few years?
Yeah, I think that the solution is going to lie somewhere along the lines of like permitting communities to have a little more freedom to set their own rules inside. I mean, for the last 50 years, the government has been penetrating these communities and saying, you know, you're not diverse enough. And the question is whether these communities, whether like, you know, groups of the, what kind of institutions these communities are going to be able to do, like take Christians, to what extent should a group of, you know, 30 or 40 Christian homeschoolers be able to have absolute leeway over who gets into their homeschooling group? Is that sort of the sort of thing that the government is allowed to scrutinize? Are they going to be allowed to do this as long as they're like an internet group, but not as long as they have a physical plot? Who has custody over the child's mind? Does the, you know, I mean, some of these things have come up in Virginia. That, I think, is where the future of these cultural conflicts is, in micro communities, in the right of people to form micro communities. Because there is, paradoxically, the one thing that the federal government approach has destroyed is diversity at the level of the group. Every group now has to be alike. It has to follow a set of rules laid down by the central authorities, and that's, people are chafing under that, let's say.
Christopher, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brendan.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.